Thank you for listening to Torah Media Atlanta. Won't you consider making a donation to help support this important work? Just go to TorahMediaAtlanta.com and click on the donate link. Thank you very much.
Parshas Chukas, as with every parsha, is full of insight. In fact, this week's parsha, we have two deaths of two of the leaders of two significant individuals of the Jewish nation. We have the death of Miriam, we have the death of Aaron, we have the punishment that is given to Moshe that he will not enter the land. It is full. However, we can't do it all, so let's focus on one detail. And that is the detail that we are introduced to in the very beginning of the parasha, and that is the very difficult mitzvah of Parah Aduma, of the red heifer. I say difficult not in its performance, difficult for two reasons. Number one, difficult because we simply don't have it in our days. There are a total of 10 red heifers that are to be burnt, and the ashes of which are to be used to deal with what we call Tumas Meis, which is the spiritual defilement that comes in the wake of anybody coming into contact with death or a dead person. And those 10, at least 9 out of 10, have already been done. The 10th and final one will be burnt in the times of Mashiach, of which we, surprisingly, will probably not need its ashes, because at that point, death will no longer be a concept in the world, because the whole purpose of death is to have the separation of soul from the body to ultimately be returned at the time of Tchias HaMeisim, resurrection of the dead. And it seems, according to most opinions, that when Mashiach's arrival comes, there will be Tchias HaMeisim, resurrection of the dead, the souls will come back to the bodies, and there won't be a concept of separation of soul from body. But without getting into all those details, because there are many questions that people have about that, and they are numerous, and I simply don't have any answers. We will find out when the time comes what the details of that are. But regardless, there are 10 total in history, and we are told about the details of this mitzvah in the very beginning of this week's parsha. Now, as an introduction, the Torah introduces this mitzvah with a particular term. And that term is to be found in the second verse, the second pasuk of this week's parsha. And the second pasuk says, Zos Chukas HaTorah. This is the decree of the Torah, Asher Tzivah Hashem Lemor, that Hashem commanded, saying, Taber el b'nei Yisrael, v'yichu elecha, speak to the Jewish people, and they should take for you Para Aduma, a red heifer, Tamima, which is pure, Asher ein b'mum, which has no blemish, Asher lo ala ala ol, which did not ever pull anything or have any yoke placed upon it. Okay? Interesting specifications for this red heifer. But the very beginning of this verse introduces this mitzvah as Zos Chukas HaTorah. This is the decree of the Torah. We do not have this term used that often, and that is simply because most, if not, I wouldn't say all, most of the mitzvahs in the Torah fall into the category of what we call Mishpatim. Mishpatim are, we could use an English word, ordinances. I'm sure there are many different words that are used to translate it. But simply said, that category of mitzvah is a category of mitzvah that the human mind can logically comprehend. The mitzvah, the commandment not to murder, the commandment not to steal, the commandment to respect father and mother. Many of the commandments fall into categories that we can logically understand. Given the faculties that God has granted us, they are what we call understandable. They have a logical basis and reason. There is, however, a category of mitzvahs. Those mitzvahs are called chukim, as another general category, and that is the concept of a mitzvah that is what we would call illogical. Or maybe not so extreme, but maybe more neutrally, simply not understandable. Not that it's particularly illogical, but they're just not understandable. We don't understand why we cannot eat pork. We don't understand why milk and meat cannot be combined. We simply don't know. And barring all the trichinosis theories, you know, it's not a question of health, it's not a question of mistreatment to animals, or any other possible theory that may be floating out there. It is simply because God said it and we do it. Period. Why do we do it? Because it is a commandment like every other commandment in the Torah. And therefore, if God tells us to do it, we do it. Period. So we have chukim and mishpatim, two general categories of mitzvahs. Mitzvahs that do have a logical basis that we can't understand, and mitzvahs that don't have a logical basis. Now, if you were God, why would you present mitzvahs that are not understandable to the human mind that you created? If you would like them to do it, why would you not give them a firm logical basis upon which to do it? Yes.
Just from my own personal experience, at first hand, when first approaching the Torah and we first begin to study it, there's so many things that are up here. And then as we keep looking and studying and more information is revealed and decoded, if you will, and we can get deeper and deeper, then we do, I think, I personally see things, maybe I don't see them correctly, I don't know. To me, they make sense, you know, and I begin to see the logic. What is beyond comprehension is that all the prophetic, everything, that these things are going to come into view without our experiencing it and on such huge scale. That's, you know, but it's all about trust and faith and knowing that everything else that has been spoken has occurred, so that's eventual also.
Okay.
I'm not sure I know the answer, but an answer to me, I've thought, would be because if every mitzvah was understandable, then man could then set himself out to be God and then create some other laws and think that they were just as good as God deciding what is right and wrong.
Okay, interesting. Any other thoughts?
Well, when my kid asks me why he can't run in the street, I say, because it says so. Shut up and don't run in the street. That's it. Potch. You know, that's, you're going to explain to him not to run in the street. By the time you explain, he'll get run over.
Okay.
Another thought.
There are different interpretations of what faith means. But one interpretation of faith is that God commands you to do this. And as an act of faith, you perform it.
Okay,
without
good.
Questioning.
So, similar.
That's what faith is, right? Belief. Okay, I like that.
Well, the same thing. I mean, that's what Torah says. God, now through God, God gave us enough laws that we do understand that make sense to us, that we should be able to have the faith, that even if he gives us something to do that we don't understand, we do it.
Okay, so let me ask you the following question, which is not as, I don't know if this is a simple question, but even more complex. Which do you believe shows more dedication to God? To do things that don't make sense, or to do things that make sense? Now, I know what you're going to answer, because obviously, the things that don't make sense shows more of a dedication to God. But let me add a little twist to that question. To do something that you do understand, but to do it for God's sake, versus to do something you don't understand for God's sake, which one is easier?
Say that again, though.
To do something that you don't understand for God's sake, versus to do something that you do understand for God's sake, which do you think is easier?
To do what you don't understand is easier.
Okay? So, to do what you don't understand for God's sake is easier than to do what you do understand. You disagree. Good,
yeah.
I'm glad. Dissenting opinion.
If you understand it, a rationale and acceptance of it should be a lot easier to do.
To do what?
For God's sake.
Okay?
No.
So I hear attention. Okay? So let me hear a remark from the other
side. You're
doing
it because you understand it. That sort of cancels doing it for God's sake. You're doing it because of your own ego and intellect.
This is exactly the tension that I wanted to create.
No,
good.
You did it.
Okay. Okay? So that's where the twist, because it would seem so logical that if you understand it, you're motivated to do it. But that wasn't the question. The question of motivation is obviously going to be easier when you do understand why you're doing something than when you don't understand. Dedication to God it's easier to be dedicated to God when you don't understand it than when you do understand it, because there is a hazard with a mitzvah that you do understand, that it's logical to you, in that there is a high probability that the true motivation will not be a dedication to God, but rather because I understand it and it makes sense to me.
You use the example of not eating pork.
Okay.
And you said that that's a halakha. So none of us eat pork. It's part of our culture. We don't question it. And it's a commandment of God.
Right.
And it's easy to do.
Okay. So you're saying once you've been trained into it, so then you just do it. The challenge that you're presenting, which I don't even know if you're presenting it, but the challenge that comes as a result of what you're saying is that we have a problem when we do anything just out of rote and routine. And that is that we have absolutely no consciousness of a relationship with God to begin with. So that's a separate problem, and it's a real problem.
I should add, I got in trouble in my younger days when I got on a platform and said, there's nothing in circumcision that's healthy. You do circumcision for one reason only, because God said so. Not because it's healthy, not because it prevents cancer. You just do it because God said.
Good for you.
Well, I got in a lot of trouble with
that.
That's
fine. We always, Jews have gotten into trouble for many things that they said. But I'm glad that you said what you feel is to be true. Hopefully you feel it to be true.
Yeah, you know, you believe it even if it makes no sense.
Right.
It's a leap of faith, as somebody once said.
Well, maybe that's before you found out that it was healthy.
No, I think the current trend is it is not healthy.
Well, it is healthy.
Well, that's
so now the challenge is that regardless of whether it's healthy or not, we do it not because it's healthy, and we shouldn't take satisfaction in the medical world that they have finally come to the realization that if God commanded it, it must be healthy, because that's still not why God commanded it. And that's tricky. It is very tricky, because we take a lot of confidence when we find the scientific world catching up, as it were, to Torah. And it's a little boost of confidence, you know, whereas for millennia we had to compete with the going opinions of either it was a Catholic Church in Copernicus days, or whether it's cosmological evidence one way or another. The Torah says what the Torah says, regardless of whether there's cosmological evidence to support it or contrary to it. So when we take comfort in the news items of the day, when finally we have some support for the Torah, and therefore now we believe in what the Torah says in a better way, that's not strengthening our faith, that's actually a weakening of faith, which is very interesting.
Could you use shotnets instead of
yes.
pork?
Let's talk about shotnets. Okay, let's get the pork off the table. Yeah. Okay, let's talk about shotnets, mixing wool and linen, which, of course, there are those that want to explain it, because talk about cosmological. In astronaut spacesuits, if there's wool and linen mixture, then radio transmissions aren't as clear as if they're... Okay, this is a fascinating discovery, and of course, again, everybody took a lot of comfort in seeing that there's some empirical evidence to support God, as though he needs any support. Yes?
All right, so I happen to have been looking at that because I'm reading Sephora Heller's book, More Precious Than Pearls.
Yes, Eishes Chayil.
Okay, so when getting to the wool and flax, so I start to look to see what's really going on here, and where is wool derived, and where is flax derived, and what is this?
Cain and Hevel.
We're talking about a plant and an animal and an intermarriage and all kinds of issues taking place here.
Right.
And the wool's coming from sheep, and we're the sheep, and so there's all different levels of this.
That's correct.
But in spite of all this, and first and foremost, this is all to elevate us spiritually. And once I think we begin this process, then we have an opportunity to look a peek beneath the veil and see what it, you know, what this is.
Good. So with that entire introduction, I thank you for that remark, because that's an important remark. I'd like to share with you a statement that Maimonides makes. Maimonides says that it is appropriate for every person to think into the mitzvos of the Torah and to understand them to the best of one's abilities. In other words, it is inappropriate to just totally on faith, God said it, I'm going to do it, and therefore why should I spend any time trying to understand? Maimonides says, no, you should, to the best of your ability, and clearly different people have different abilities, and to the best of your ability, you have a responsibility, not a responsibility, but it is appropriate, says Maimonides. Now, let's say you encounter a dead end. You find that there's a mitzvah that you simply do not have an understanding of. So Maimonides says that in the event that you encounter a mitzvah that you don't fully appreciate or don't understand, do not let it be seen by you as light. As light. In other words, this does not indicate the quality of the mitzvah, the fact that you don't fully appreciate what its underpinnings are. And you shouldn't dismantle it. But rather, you should recognize that God has ultimately commanded us to do it. And it is God's wisdom, the supernal wisdom of God, that has indicated to us what the basis of this mitzvah really is. And I want to share with you a statement that is expressed. It's really echoing Maimonides, but this is said by somebody a little more recent, and that is Rabbi Samson Raphael Hirsch. And in his classic book on the mitzvahs called Chorev, perhaps you've seen it, translated by Rabbi Grunfeld, so he writes as follows. He says that we have seen that the basis of the binding power of the commandments of the Torah is not our acknowledgement of their moral and human value, nor our finding, with our limited human insight into the essence of things, reasons for these laws which would satisfy us, but rather the fact that God has commanded them. Period. It is considered meritorious to meditate on the laws of the Torah and to rethink the divine thoughts which are embedded in them. Only we must not allow our inability to find the ultimate reasons of the laws to influence our obedience to them. Adherence to our religious laws must never be made dependent on our finding reasons for them which are acceptable to us. And finally, just to recap, he says, meditation on our religious laws means rather to search for their underlying ideas, their conception, their rationale, in order to make them a spiritual force in our life. So in other words, we have this delicate balance between seeking reasons, but understanding that any reason that we understand, or we read, or we study about, is only a reason, never the reason. And that is a distinction that always needs to be ever present in our mind when we study, when we try to find the underpinnings, whether it be rational, whether it be Kabbalistic. Regardless, the motivation to doing the will of God has to remain in a pure faith-based trust in God. God has commanded us to do things. Only God knows the ultimate reasons for why he has created those mitzvahs. And in as much as we have many sources for trying to attempt to understand the reasons, those are merely a reason, never the reason. In fact, very interestingly, the word for reason in Hebrew is, anybody know?
Reason.
Tom. Tom. Yeah. There we go.
Taste.
Tom is a reason.
Taste.
Now, Tom is a taste.
Taste.
So, it's a real confusing language when the same word is used for two very different things. A reason and a taste in the English language have nothing to do with each other. But interestingly enough, the fact that the same word is used clearly indicates that there must be an underlying relationship between the two. And indeed, many of the commentaries say that a reason of the mitzvah is merely giving it taste in order to make it more palatable to us. Because we are much more motivated, in the words of Rabbi Hirsch, in order to make them a spiritual force in our life, we are much more motivated to do things that we understand than the things that we don't understand. And therefore, the prevalence of mitzvahs that do have a logical basis are much greater in number than the ones that don't have a logical basis. So when we think about the reasons of the mitzvahs, we always have to think of taste. In the words of the Sefer HaChinuch, the book of education, which was written in approximately the 1600s, it was written anonymously. Mm-hmm. I think we've, at least at this point in history, we have ascribed it to Rabbi Aaron of Barcelona, if I'm not mistaken. Regardless, he goes through every mitzvah divided by the weekly portion, and he gives what he calls the Ta'am HaMitzvah. And at the end of the book of Vayikra, he has a little addendum at the very end of the book, and he says that, by the way, it's almost as though like he has to remind the reader what the entire motivation to write this book is. He says that I called this book the Sefer HaChinuch because I wrote it for children in order for them to appreciate and understand the mitzvos. And he said, just as a parent will give an apple to a child, and he's giving the apple to the child because of its nutrition, the value of nutrition, the medicinal qualities of this apple, but he's not going to tell that to the kid, because the kid is surely not going to be motivated to eat the apple because of its nutrition value. He's going to eat the apple because it tastes good. So the more superficial one is in his observance, the more one needs taste to get them motivated. But as you said, as you become more dedicated to being submissive, subordinate to God's will, the less of a need you have to depend on the taste for the purpose of the ultimate goal, which is to fulfill God's will. So this realm of ta'amei mitzvos, of reasons for mitzvos, is tricky. On the one hand, it gets us excited, it gives us a motivation to do, but on the other hand, it's almost like training wheels, that there is a end, hopefully, in sight, that I won't need these to motivate me to do it, because ultimately I will have built my trust in God that I submit totally without question. The reasons are wonderful, but they're extras. They're not the basis for which I do it. Okay? Any questions? Okay. There is a statement, not a statement, a story. A story that is brought in the Jerusalem Talmud. The story is about a fellow by the name of Dama ben Nesina. You may have heard his name, and if you haven't, now you have. And this story is brought in Tractate Kedushin in the context of a discussion that relates to the mitzvah of kibud avim, honoring parents. And the Talmud says the following. It talks about two different episodes in Dama ben Nesina's life just to indicate his dedication to this mitzvah of kibud avim, of honoring parents. He said one time he was the head of a troop in the military, and his mother came along, and in front of his entire platoon, she took off her shoe, and she started hitting him. All right. Mothers could be that way. Some mothers. And the Talmud says that in the midst of her hitting him on the head, clearly he was shamed, embarrassed, and had to deal with the indignity of that episode. But the shoe fell out of her hand. And as soon as it fell to the floor, Dama bent down, grabbed it, and picked it up and gave it to her so that she wouldn't have to bend down to pick it up. All right? Don't use this as a litmus test for your own personal fulfillment of that mitzvah. That's story number one. Story number two is that there was a stone that was missing from the Choshen. Choshen is the breastplate of the Kohen Gadol, and we know that for every tribe there was another color stone. And the stone for the tribe of Binyamin was called the Yashpeh. What exactly it is in English, I don't know, but take a look at the Parsha of Tetzaveh and Shmos, and perhaps the...
Jasper.
Is it Jasper? Could be. Don't know. But you can take a look over there and see how they translate. So this particular stone fell out of the Choshen and was missing. So the sages needed to find a replacement. So they put out a classified ad. If anybody has one of these stones at home, just let us know. Maybe Craigslist, I don't know. So they indicated to the sages that this fellow, Dovin ben Asina, has this stone in his possession, and it's probably worth your while to go visit. So they went over to him, and they decided to offer him 100 dinar, quite a sum of money, for this stone. So he said, no problem, let me go get it. So the Talmud describes that he went to go get it, and he found that his father was sleeping. Some say that the key to the safe that this stone was in was on his finger, or some say under his pillow, and some say his leg was on the box that it was in. Whatever it is, the bottom line is that he did not want to wake up his father in order to retrieve the stone to be able to sell it to the sages. So he turned to them and he said, I'm very sorry, I could not get it for you. So they thought to themselves, nobody can get anything unless the price is right. So let's change the offer. So they increased the offer significantly, they doubled the money, and they went all the way up to 1,000 dinar. And he kept on saying, thank you, but no thank you, I really can't do it. My father's sleeping right now. Anyways, the sages went along their merry way, and the father eventually woke up. So the Talmud describes that he went, and he got the key, and he got the stone, and he sent a messenger to them, and he said, I got it, I'm ready to sell it. So they came back, and they offered him the 1,000 dinar that was the final figure. And he said, no, I'm going to revert back to the original fee, because why would I want to benefit financially from my fulfillment of the mitzvah of honoring my father? That's not why I did it. I didn't do it for the money. I did it for the mitzvah. So I'd rather go back to the original amount that we made up prior to my realization that it was my father sleeping that prevented me from giving it to you. So they reverted it back, and he was happy that he fulfilled the mitzvah. He got his 100 dinar. They were happy that they got the Yashbe stone, and as they say, the rest is history. Okay, so now what happened? So the rest wasn't history, because the Talmud says that there's one extra detail that you need to know, and that is that God rewarded Dama ben Asina. What did he reward him with? A para aduma. A red heifer was born into his flock, and that was the reward he got for what he did. Okay, the end, and everybody lived happily ever after. The lesson that I would like to focus on, which doesn't seem like a lesson at this point, is usually God rewards people measure for measure. And it would seem rather odd for us to have a situation of a fellow doing this, and then as a reward, getting a red heifer in his flock. What does one have to do with another?
Right.
Doesn't seem like there is any relationship. So I'd like to suggest the following. This isn't my suggestion. This is actually a suggestion that I found in a text called the Meshech Chachma. Meshech Chachma is written by somebody by the name of Rav Meir Simcha of Dvinsk, Russia, approximately 200 years ago, and he wrote the following thought, and he is discussing the mitzvah of Kibud Avim. The mitzvah of Kibud Avim, which is an interesting mitzvah. Why is it an interesting mitzvah? So, the question that I have for all of you is that we know that the mitzvah of Kibud Avim, which is honoring father and mother, is one of the Ten Commandments. So that's not so much of a question, because we would perhaps consider it quite fundamental. The real problem is that it's on the first of the two tablets. Now, we have become familiar with the division of the two tablets. One is between man and God, one is between man and man, and that is kind of a very convenient way of dividing the two until we actually do a little research and discover that the fifth commandment, meaning the one that's still the last one on the tablet of man-God relationships, is honor your father and your mother, which is quite perplexing because it is a interpersonal thing. And yet, somehow, deep down, we kind of feel that perhaps it isn't. Clearly it isn't, because it's on the wrong tablet. So evidently, Kibud Avim has much more to do with man-God than it has to do with between a child and his or her parents. Well, then what is it? Or maybe I should say, perhaps our allocation of the two tablets is incorrect. It's not man, God, man, man, but rather subordination to authority is the first one, and respect for humanity is the second one. Come on, Rabbi, you're really confusing us.
Yeah.
Which means that if the first tablet represents submission to authority, it would make a lot of sense for the first four to be referring to God issues, but the fifth one referring to one's parents. Why? Says the Meshech Chachma, because essentially, beyond the more basic understanding of kibud av v'em, honoring one's father and mother out of gratitude for what they've done for you, there's a much greater underpinning to the mitzvah, and that is to give you a first opportunity for submission to an authority figure in your life as a stepping stone to ultimately get to a submission to the ultimate authority in life. So that we need a more immediate encounter with authority to get us prepped for the ultimate goal. And really, essentially, this represents a basic description of reality in that God created many elements of this physical world to reflect spiritual ideas. It's just that we have a very difficult time connecting to things that are way beyond our realm of experience. So God gave us examples in a small way, small-scale examples, so that we can conceptualize these ideas. So that when we talk about the relationship between the Jews and God as a relationship between husband and wife, that's not just allegorical. That's meant to be able to indicate to us that if you are doing what you're supposed to be doing in your relationship with your spouse, then that will give you a small window into understanding the potential of the relationship between the Jewish people and God. So that the whole concept of parents and spouses and children, God obviously could have created this world in any which way he wanted, but he created a physical reality to reflect on spiritual ideals, spiritual goals. So that when we have this mitzvah of kibud av v'em, of honoring parents, we could see it as simply a method by which the children are supposed to express gratitude to the primary caregivers in their life, or we could see it even beyond that, and that is our first introduction to submission to authority. Now, once we understand that kibud av v'em is just that, and therefore it's listed in the first five commandments because it is an authority thing, that ability to submit to authority is exactly what is taking place in the mitzvah of Parah Aduma. Because essentially, what we started our discussion with is to understand what the purpose of chukim are. The purpose of chukim is so that you ultimately submit to the ultimate authority. Which means that it's not about me understanding this, because if I understand it and that's why I do it, who am I serving? Myself! I'm serving myself! I'm not serving God. If I need to understand what I'm doing before I do it, that's the ultimate rejection of authority. Because that means I couldn't care less what you say. I need to understand. If I don't understand, I don't do. If I do understand, I do. And the concept of authority states the exact opposite. That if you're going to do something, I would rather you do something that you don't understand, because there is no other basis for you doing it other than submitting to authority. So, Parah Aduma is the ultimate expression of a chok, which is submission to authority. Kibud av v'em is the mitzvah of submission to authority. The entire story of Dama ben Nissina is kibud av v'em, his recognition of his parents being the stepping stone to God. And therefore God responded in suit and gave him the Parah Aduma, which is the chok, which is the ultimate expression of submission to God's will.
My rabbi would teach me that that's true, but you must honor the fifth commandment unless they tell you to violate the fourth commandment.
Right.
Which is honor the Sabbath. In other words, if your parent tells you don't keep the Sabbath, you don't have to listen.
Because it's only a stepping stone to the ultimate authority. The ultimate authority always trumps.
Yeah.
So when we realize, and you know, I was thinking about this concept last week, I was speaking to a parent who was undergoing the frustration of every parent of every teenager, which is that while children are young, it is very easy, maybe not very easy, but it is easier to elicit obedience, because children up until a certain age don't feel that they could assert their own, first of all, they don't have their own identity yet. They're struggling with separation. They kind of feel that their identity is subsumed under yours. And it's during those teenage years where they finally start emerging as individuals. And that friction, the challenge, the dynamic that takes place at that time is extraordinarily stormy. Because on the one hand, you as a parent, you want to assert your authority on them. On the other hand, you don't want them to lose that sense of identity that they are emerging with. But as soon as they emerge with identity, their own identity, and they realize that, hey, one second, not everything that my parents said is for my best interest. Sometimes it seems to me that it's self-serving. And the day comes when the temerity factor, the chutzpah, ends up coming out. And they say, no, I don't want to do it because I don't understand why I need to do it. And that is when you as a parent are challenged with the ultimate challenge of parenthood. And that is, how do you assert your authority in a situation where your authority is being challenged? So one method is physical violence, and that'll teach them, which we all know is not ideal and clearly a very weak response, not weak in the strength of a smack, but weak in the sense that if that's going to be the basis of my authority, gosh, I really have to rethink this. And we all of a sudden get a sense of, I have lost control. Where really you lost control a long time ago. It's just that you never had a child that was willing to show you that you've lost control, or maybe you never had it. So to me it seems that every home requires two parents, not just two parents because of the male-female complementing skills and comportments, etc., etc., but also that each spouse needs to support the other one's authority so that the authority that you are positing, you are submitting, is not built upon your own assertion of that authority. In other words, it's a very weak position to say, you need to listen to me because I'm your father, or because I'm your mother, right? Because you very well know that the child is looking at you saying, so what? Like, of course you want me to do what you want me to do. But when someone else sticks up for your authority or establishes your authority, if your wife or if your husband does that, there is a much stronger sense of authority because it doesn't appear as self-serving. That is number one. Number two, it seems to me, that the only way that you can teach is by modeling behavior. Every parent knows that it's not about do as I say, not as I do, because at a certain point, the kid is going to say, yeah, it's a bunch of hogwash. There's no value system here that's being taught to me. And therefore, they rebel, and they do their own thing. But if you want to teach a value system of submission to authority, then it would seem to me that the only way to do that is by modeling that behavior. So that if the child never has an opportunity to see you submitting to authority in a way that's unquestionable, then there is no way that they will be taught what that means. And unfortunately, in our society, regardless of the fact, the obvious fact, that many authority figures in our world aren't deserving of the authority that they are given, they have not lived up to the expectations of people. And therefore, we dismantle their authority because we don't feel that they're discerned, because they're not people of integrity, they're not people that are worthy of respect. But God help us if we cannot find at least one individual in our lives that we do respect and we do submit to their authority, regardless of whether we fully understand their position or not. Because that will be the only true way that our children will learn what that means. And if they see it in you, then you can very well expect it in them. But without that, it is virtually impossible to assert your authority in a way that teaches a child that there are times in life where you don't have the full picture. You aren't mature enough to recognize the factors that I'm considering. You don't have the experience. Oh yeah, Dad? Oh yeah, Mom? You seem to think that you have all the experience. When did you ever submit to another authority that has more experience than you? When have you ever asked the big questions in life to those that you respect, to your mentors, to the rabbi, to anybody that will tell you something that you're not happy about because you think otherwise? But you say, it's not about me, because I'm clearly limited, and I have to ask, I have to seek somebody above me to find out what to do. And when you present that conversation at the dinner table, you don't have to say anything else. Just that alone speaks volumes of humility, of the ability to submit, of the ability to show deference, of the ability to show how it's our submission that will ultimately get to our relationship with God, and that the child will get that loud and clear. Just a thought.
Well, that's why you need grandparents.
Yes, I was actually thinking about that, that sometimes when grandparents live in the home or in close proximity, and the children see how the parents behave and deal with the parents, which unfortunately is not always a good thing for the kids to see, because we sometimes fall short of how we deal with our own parents. And especially when we're not in their presence, but when we're in the children's presence, and they hear how we talk about them. And, you know, when conversations at the dinner table revolve around how the teacher did X, and you as a parent get upset, and you start bad-mouthing the teacher, well, not every teacher has to be correct, but show some deference. Show some element of respect, and maybe not in front of the kids, call up the teacher and ask. But don't badmouth the teacher in front of the kids. And you may justify it, you may say, I have to teach my kids that they have to understand that not every decision by authority. Okay, that's great. Is that tempered with at least some vestige of respect for authority? Every talk show, every radio program, every political cartoon, every blog, everything out there is cutting every authority figure down to size. So, what are we left with? If we're going to teach a value to our children, it's to, yes, we have to be discerning in who we respect. They have to live up to our expectations. What those expectations need to be, that's a good question. But once they've proven that they are worthy of our trust, to continue to broadcast those signals of submission and deference. Because it's going to be the only venue of that opportunity that your children will ever have in this world. Have a great Shabbat.
Thank you for listening to Torah Media Atlanta. Won't you consider making a donation to help support this important work? Just go to TorahMediaAtlanta.com and click on the donate link. Thank you very much.